Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We're pleased to announce that financial assistance awards totaling $2 billion to reach more than 43,000 individuals have been made under the Discrimination Financial Assistance Program, which has been possible by Section 22007 of the Inflation Reduction Act.
That's White House Director of Public Engagement, Steve Benjamin.
This announcement is a result of hours of hard work by many individuals at USDA and by third-party organizations. It's only one part of an enormous, commendable effort at USDA to make its programs more accessible and equitable for all who want to participate in agriculture. President Biden is committed to advancing equity in agriculture and ensuring that every farmer and rancher across the country has the tools and resources needed to continue to be successful in providing the United States and the world with food, fiber, and fuel, as many of them have done for generations.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, the capital markets certainly are being challenged at the moment.
Bob Maurer, Manduka Trading in Chicago, following a wild ride on Monday.
The markets had a really good slide, as I'm sure anybody knows who's been paying any attention to either the financial news or otherwise. That started on primarily Friday, although I would say and argue that the market had been soft for the last couple weeks. And then along comes the data on early Thursday and Friday to help accelerate this thing lower, and it has responded accordingly. So the market back in mid-July or so topped off, right? I mean, we made new swing highs, new contract highs in the September S&P futures on July 16th, so right about the mid-month mark, got up to about 5720-ish or so and started to fall back. And then we had some consolidation last week, at least the first half of last week. And then Thursday we got some data that came out that wasn't necessarily kind to the market, that being some weaker numbers from the ISM manufacturing and also the jobless claims numbers. But then I guess the big one that really missed the mark was the employment situation number that came out on Friday, missing the mark by quite a bit. So net-net, markets are taking all that information and reacting accordingly. We're also getting some help to the bearish side with some of the other countries out there, such as Japan, who are making moves and seeing their markets kind of get hit too. So it's kind of just worked its way bit by bit across the globe, and we saw some follow through today. Bigger picture, how would that affect our commodity markets that we talk about? And if you just kind of do a scan and think of the narrative of what's happening in some of the sectors, I would say it's unsurprising that you would see the energies lower, although crude, as we speak, is only down about 15 cents a barrel, heating oil down about 100 points, RBOB actually up 2.5. So that's 250 points, that is. So you would think that you would see some kind of move to the downside in energies, being that if the thought process is that the stock markets are sending you a signal, okay, if you were a believer of this at this point, that recession down the road is a possibility, a greater possibility than it was, say, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, then you would think that that would be having some kind of negative impact in the energy markets, being that if it just comes down to how you want to spend your money family by family across the United States of America, might you pull back a little bit on some travel, right? So that would reduce the demand for unleaded gas and reduce the demand for crude oil. So things like that. So that's just a narrative that could work into that marketplace. When you think about some of the agricultural futures that we chat about week in and week out, I don't necessarily think that there's going to be a longer term impact in corn, wheat, and soybeans to an extent, at least not as much of an impact in some of the higher protein categories of meat that might get pulled back on. For example, cattle. Cattle's been on a good run to the upside. Cattle's not cheap. You go to the grocery store and it's pretty expensive to buy a nice cut of beef these days. And if that recessionary thought caused by these macro markets kind of works its way into the day-to-day consumer out there having to go to the grocery store, then you would think that there would be some kind of push to the downside in live cattle futures. And we did see that today. The cattle market in October is down about 300 points. Feeder cattle are down anywhere from 4 to about 650 points. So maybe that's more of an impact, or that's being more impacted, shall we say, by some of the macro events in the capital markets. Speaking as a true potential complete novice economist,
it's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, timing of corn silage harvest always is heavily dependent on the weather.
So Dr. Mike Brook is a Kansas State University dairy specialist. Talks today about silage harvest.
Generally, we assume that we're going to probably start our corn silage harvest about 40 to 45 days after the corn has started silking. But that is highly dependent on the weather conditions that we might be having at the time of harvest. You know, as we think about corn silage harvest, a lot of times our thoughts as far as timing are concerned about the dry matter content of the whole plant, and that is important. However, I want to encourage you that as we consider our harvest this year, we also need to consider what the maturity is of the kernel. So ideally, we would like to have corn silage that's about 35 to 38% dry matter, and that would be based on the whole plant dry matter content. However, if we want to have maximum starch content and keep in mind that grain represents about 50% of the total dry matter yield in good corn silage, it also represents about 65% of the energy that the animals will derive from the corn silage. So as we start to think about that, as we think about the time from about one-half milk line to about three-quarters milk line, this is a critical period for the increase in the starch content of your corn silage. So if you have adequate whole plant moisture and you can wait just a few days to allow those kernels to continue to mature and get a little bit deeper before you actually pull the trigger on harvest, it will increase the starch content of your corn silage. In fact, under certain growing conditions, starch content on a dry matter basis may increase by as much as 1% each day as we delay harvest, assuming that we have adequate moisture and that we're not dealing with a situation where we have droughty conditions and the corn is actually either dead or in the process of dying. Also, leaf diseases may figure into this equation too, as some of our leaf diseases, if we have not treated our fields for those, are likely to increase toward the end of the fill period for the corn. The plant will actually die, start losing moisture quickly, and grain fill will cease. So as you think about your corn silage harvest, make sure that you do determine what the whole plant moisture is. And it's important that you select a representative number of stalks from the field and chop those. Generally, we recommend using a leaf chopper to do that. And make sure as you select your sample from that chopped material that you take handfuls from different places in the pile so that you actually do have a representative sample that you actually dry down. It's usually important to dry two or three samples down to make sure that you've taken adequate number of samples to determine an accurate dry matter for that material. Keep in mind, dry matter content, again, depending on the weather conditions at the time, may change fairly dramatically each day. Sometimes we can lose as much as a point to a point and a half of moisture each day, depending on the temperature and wind. So keep those things in mind as you determine when you should pull that trigger as far as starting your corn silage harvest.
That's Kansas State dairy specialist Dr. Mike Brook, and this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We have seen both corn and soybean prices fall in recent months.
University of Illinois ag economist Gary Schnittke.
USDA is now projecting the 24-25 market year average price to be $11.20 for soybeans and $4.40 for corn. The 2024 marketing year runs from September 2024 through August 2025, so this is the period in which the corn that's produced in 24 will be marketed. That $4.40 price for corn is a dramatic fall, falling from $6.54 in 2022, and similarly, soybean prices fell from $14.20 to $11.20. In 2022, we had high prices caused by a number of factors with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. conflict being a major one, as well as supply issues someplace around the world. Lackluster yields in Brazil, Argentina, and the United States. From those highs, we have fallen to 440 projected for 24, and we likely have lower prices moving forward even than that 440. And if you're looking at the year after, futures markets would suggest $4.25 for the corn price, $11 for the soybean price. Overall, when we were in 2022, many had hopes that we had reached a new higher plateau. And if you look at corn and soybean prices, they tend to vary around a plateau, moving above it and below it, but not trending up or down. Since 2006, we have had an average plateau or average price of $4.55 for corn and $11 for soybeans. Again, we were hoping that the 2022 situation represented a new higher plateau, but now prices suggest that that isn't going to be a new higher plateau. It generally takes something of a long-run change in supply and demand conditions to raise that plateau. In 2006, that was the ethanol build, along with continued strong demand for soybeans in the export market. We now look like we are on the same plateau, and just in the past, once those transitory supply and demand situations work themselves out, can be in a period of lower prices. How long that period lasts depends. The last one, which began in 2015, lasted 7 years. We've seen 7 to 8 years of lower prices or below those plateaus in the past, and we could again see a price period where low prices persist for several years. How long that persists can't be predicted. The supply and demand conditions that will cause us to be above our plateau are difficult, if not impossible, to predict. So we are again in a period of lower prices. Since we're in a period of lower prices, costs typically don't move back down to lower levels. And in fact, they typically stay at new higher levels, moving down some, with fertilizer costs being the major item that moved down. But overall, we're looking at a period of lower returns, and if we're thinking about operator and land returns, or return to the land and the farmer, those could be below cash rents for a number of years, just like they were in the 2015 through 2019 period.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The stepped-up basis is a tax provision that allows the value of inherited assets to be adjusted to the fair market value at the time of the original owner's death.
Ag economist, UNL's Center for Ag Profitability, Anastasia Mayer, on what stepped-up basis is.
So this adjustment increases the assets basis, which is the value used to determine capital gains or losses when the asset is eventually sold by the heir. So this asset has to be inherited from one generation to another. It is especially useful for those family-owned farms that are looking at inheritance as a way to pass on land, stocks, other assets to the next generation.
How can it affect capital gains?
By stepping up the basis to the asset's current market value, any appreciation that occurred during the original owner's lifetime is not subject to capital gains tax. So this reduces the tax liability significantly for whoever inherited those assets if they choose to sell those assets. Long-term capital gain tax taxes are taxed at a much lower rate relative to other types of income. And land and some other high-value assets have a rapid appreciation over someone's lifetime, which makes it a concern for people looking to sell when they retire, or people inheriting the farm if they want to sell the ranch or farm or other assets. So the stepped-up basis helps with those rapidly appreciating assets.
And so one of the biggest question is, what can be affected?
Current law not only supports a stepped up basis for grain, machinery, and land, but also prepaid assets on hand. So if you have stocks, those can be a stepped up basis. Grain, if you have an elevator or you have grain in the elevator or bin of grain that you inherit, that can be stepped up. And so maybe that's when we might see a loss on if you sell it. The machinery, livestock, it's all important to start documenting the values of those on the day of somebody's death. Now, that's a really difficult thing to do because as we grieve, that's not the first thing that is going to be popping in our head saying, hey, somebody I loved passed away. I'm inheriting stuff. What's the value of that tractor right now? But it is important to start collecting data as soon as you can on the values of these. Sometimes it's difficult to find the information for years after the fact. If you inherit land, I highly suggest that you have an appraisal done at the time the property is inherited to establish that new stepped-up basis. For other investments such as stocks, machinery, keep those documents. If you turn in a balance sheet to the bank, keep those documents and other published market data in a file somewhere to establish those stepped-up basis, especially if you are thinking that you will be selling land or those other assets or in the next few years if you don't have anybody to pass it on to.
Anastasia Mayer with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Beef stress is really the mechanisms that cattle try to adapt to a warmer temperature.
Kansas State veterinarian A.J. Tarpoff.
You and I, whenever we get hot, we sweat, right? And that's a way of to be able to pull some of that heat away. The sweat evaporates and it pulls that heat off the body. So we're trying to maintain homeostasis. Well, for our livestock species, and especially cattle, they don't have the sweat producing capabilities. So what they do is they try to dissipate heat in other ways by, one, getting into more comfortable areas. Two, they've actually increased their respiratory rate or their breathing. So they use their lungs, believe it or not, to be able to dissipate some of that heat. So what we'll see is animals start to pant. Okay, so if you can picture a dog panting, those are things that we might see as the body temperature starts to increase in cattle, that we'll start seeing some of those symptoms like heavier breathing or even open mouth breathing.
Says there are four components to stress.
So when we think about heat stress or cold stress, any environmental stressor, there's four key parameters that we really think about with heat stress. And, you know, obviously temperature and humidity. Everybody, when you wake up in the morning, check the news, you hear the forecast, and you'll get temperature. Okay. Well, temperature is only one piece of the pie. For how our animals really feel the environment around them, it's temperature, humidity, which we think about the humidity index, right? Sometimes we'll have some of those index scores that you'll hear on the radio or hear on the news. But with cattle, we take it a step further. The other two parameters that are missing in that heat index are wind speed and solar radiation. Okay. Those four parameters really make up on what the real feel. For, you know, if we really start thinking along the lines of how cattle feel the environment, because they're very different from us. Where we're comfortable, cattle, you know, they might be uncomfortable, and vice versa. So when we really need to take into those four key parameters. And what's interesting is we actually have that in a model called an Animal Comfort Index, and that's available on the Kansas MesNet website. So it uses those four parameters to give a real feel on how cattle are experiencing the environment.
Why should we be concerned?
Why we care, why we manage, why we, you know, really worry about this is it's the day in and day out. It is one of those critical chores just as important as feeding or making sure the animals have water. Providing animal comfort is really an investment in our animals, whether we're asking them to be reproductive cows, okay, out in the pasture, whether we're asking that animal to produce beef in a feedlot, whatever we're asking that animal to do, when we invest in animal comfort, when scenarios get uncomfortable, when we invest in them, make them more comfortable, they are more productive, they're more profitable, and they really sustain, and we kind of build that suspension under those animals where they can handle more of some of the environmental constraints that are around them.
Other physical signs.
So some of the other physical signs, yes, we'll see increased breathing rates. One interesting piece is cattle, they don't lay down as much, especially whenever they get heat stress. They're trying to increase airflow. Unfortunately, that might lead to bunching, where groups of cattle, even in a pasture, will bunch up together. They're trying to get increased airflow, but they end up using each other as shade, which is kind of counterproductive. So we need to keep a close eye for that. Now, when given access, cattle may crowd around water tanks. Right? Go down into ponds if they're out in a pasture. Unfortunately, that can lead to some problems where they don't have enough access to water, especially for a water tank. We'll always see the one animal standing in the water tank when the rest of them are trying to drink. So we have grouping, we have bunching, we have water-seeking and shade-seeking behaviors, and a lot increased standing. Okay, so those are all kind of different things that we can see when animals start to heat up or to experience some of those heat stress.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There was a recent case that went before the Supreme Court arguing about a proposed federal rule and an argument that there was overreach or that the federal rule went beyond what the statutory authority provided.
Brad Lubin is an associate professor and extension policy specialist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and is looking at the 1984 Chevron Doctrine.
Well, there's a specific argument about whether the rule is above and beyond statutory authority, but embedded in that argument is the argument that the federal agency shouldn't be the one to interpret whether the rule is reasonable or not in the first place. The agency is there to create the rule. The argument was we shouldn't be relying on the Chevron doctrine that says the agency gets to create the rule and they get to basically determine whether their rule is reasonable or not. So a 40-year precedent has been eliminated here with the ruling this year from the Supreme Court.
So again, the Chevron doctrine basically struck down, but Lubin says it's interesting about the doctrine and the idea of government overreach.
Well, it's also interesting to point out, as I understand it, you know, there's quite a bit of interest here and some thoughts in many ag communities that the repeal or the overruling of the Chevron doctrine implies that federal government overreach has been struck down and that we might see less regulatory burden or pressure from the federal government. Interestingly enough, this original case was brought about, the Chevron versus Natural Resource Defense Council case was brought about, as I understand it, because Chevron argued that interpretation went too far. The rule went too far and that the federal agency should have deference to write a rule that's reasonable. So 40 years ago.
Over environmental concerns.
40 years ago, the Chevron doctrine worked to sort of, allow the agency's deference to not overreach. 40 years later, we argued that the Chevron doctrine is basically allowing federal agencies to overreach. Well, it depends on which case you have and which side of the aisle you're on as to whether a rule works in your favor or not in your favor. It very well could mean that it's more challenging going forward. As a good example of that, think of the Waters of the United States rule. We have federal legislation in the Clean Water Act that dates to the early 1970s. We have an original definition from the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that dates to the 1980s. And we had decades of sort of case law and regulatory decisions based on that before Supreme Court cases began to chip away at that definition. We have had three successive administrations write a new proposed rule basically with the same still the same legislative instructions. Assuming that we're going to get perfectly clear legislative language and instructions to write rules in the future is a real challenge in and of itself. And I think that's the challenge for any federal legislation. If we take the time to be more specific and more clear and remove any ambiguity, it's more difficult and it takes more time. We have a farm bill that's already overdue and lengthy process to try and get it to the finish line. This kind of challenge makes it even more difficult. So So yes, it could impact the timing of the Farm Bill as well as other major legislation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The USDA is out with its ag prices report for June, and as usual, it's a mix of good and not so good news, roughly looking favorable for most livestock producers, problematic for most row crop growers. One general theme, though, was a decline in the prices producers had to pay to do business. That prices paid index dropping microscopically during June, taking it down below last year, but by only 0.1%. Looking at June crop prices, mostly down. For corn, the average June price, $4.48 a bushel, down 3 cents during June, leaving corn $2 below June a year ago. Wheat, a 33-cent drop in June, leaving wheat $1.81 below a year ago at an average $5.86 a bushel. Meanwhile, if you want to see products doing better than a year ago, just flip the report over to the livestock section, where you will see higher prices than a year ago for most every product except broilers and turkey. Gary Crawford, Washington.